My name is Sharon, and I serve the village's education lead, and it's been my joy to help plan with teaching faculty for all this summer. So what a pleasure to see all of you here today. I'd like to introduce you to Dan Spencer. Dan is a longtime villager, started teaching in 1986, I believe. Do I have the year right? And is now a professor at the University of Montana. And last he taught was last fall at Autumn Sojourners, and got a little glimpse of this. So Dan will be teaching five times, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 11, and Tuesday and Thursday at 2:45, all in the end by our site. So we look forward to having you this week and next.
Thank you. Thanks so much. But Sharon mentioned, I was out here in the fall for the Autumn Sojourn, and the folks who organized that week asked me to do three sessions on the concept of deep time. And I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by that. That's something we in geology, my background's in geology, talk about here. And we had just a really fun time with the conversation there. The problem was I had way too much material for three sessions. So what I've basically done is taken that same material and spread it out over five sessions so that we'll have actually time to talk with each other about these things here. Just a few things of preface to say by way of background here. I imagine a number of you were at Hal Taussig's session at 9 this morning here. And one of the things we have in common is that Hal really talks about the importance of story as shaping who we are. And we were looking at the Gospel of Mark this morning, and Mark presenting a story that helped people in his time make sense of the incredible trauma of the Roman occupation of Palestine. And every culture, every religious tradition organizes itself around central stories, and those stories help us get a sense of, I always tell my students, good stories do three things. They tell us where we've come from, that is something about our origins, where we are now, something about our identity, and where we're headed, something about our destiny. And the biblical story does all three of those in really, really masterful ways. This is a story that is going to expand that in some sense, but I think you will also be able to locate the biblical story within this story. This is a story that's really just been emerging in the last couple centuries, and in some ways really the last few decades, where we can understand much better the story of the universe ourselves, we find ourselves located in here. And so when I saw that the summer theme was beginning together, well, I thought, what better thing to talk about than the beginning of the universe and what we're learning about that here. Now, let me just start with a couple of trivia questions, then I'm going to play the movies with time on that here. But a couple hundred years ago, what was the consensus age of the Earth? That everybody who was educated knew the Earth was this old, at least in the Western tradition. See, probably about 6,000 years, about 4,000 BCE, about 6,000 years. And that was came about through a lot of rigorous scholarship. We look at that today and we kind of think, how could they thought that? Well, given the tools that they had, this was a really highly educated understanding. They looked at a lot of the ancient manuscripts, they put all the evidence they could. And what was the operative mechanism that shaped most of the earth?
Creation.
God, but through what act?
Creation.
Got to think about Genesis 7, 8, 9. The flood, Noah's flood story, okay? And so this is a really, really interesting thing. And that was, all scientists were in the West were working with that, trying to use the flood story to understand the surface features we have here. What has happened in those couple hundred years here is we've gone from about 6,000 years to about 13.7 billion years is our best understanding of the age of the universe here. And one other question here. Anybody heard of Hubble? Hubble telescope, all right? So, Edwin Hubble was an astronomer in the 1920s. He was working in the telescopes in Southern California, and he had a burning question. He wanted to know whether there was more galaxies out there than the one that we live in. The only galaxy we knew up to that point was the Milky Way. And that itself had been a huge accomplishment to understand that we are part of a solar system in a galaxy. But he wanted to get it. So about 90 years ago, we knew that there was one galaxy in the universe. Any idea now how much scientists think, how many galaxies we think there are?
Billions.
Yeah, we're somewhere, and the numbers estimate, but we have pretty good, at least evidence for about 200 billion galaxies. And each galaxy having 100 to 200 billion stars in them. So we're talking about trillions of stars. So what happens to our stories when in a relatively, my grandparents were raising their kids at that point when this new information came to the FL. So when we begin to add that kind of numbers, both in terms of length of time and expansion of space, things to our stories, we have to start reimagining what those stories can look like and how we fit in them. And it's a daunting but really kind of thrilling and exciting task there. So when I talk about deep time, I'm talking about moving away from a human scale of time where we see things on the order of generations and maybe up to a few thousand years. So now we're talking really about hundreds of millions, if not billions of years. Those numbers get so large, it's really hard for me to even conceive of what they mean. But one of them, we'll talk more about this here. I want to film talk most here. So what I'd like to do is we're going to watch half of it today, which will get us up to the evolution of life. And then we'll watch the other half tomorrow, which will bring us from life up to humans in that point here. But one of the things I want you to be aware of, I use this film with my students in a class I teach called Nature and Society. And I had to remind them that we're going to start at the biggest scale, the sort of so-called Big Bang or the beginning of the entire universe. And the story is going to progressively narrow down until we eventually get to human beings on this earth. But keep in mind, even though we're narrowing our attention, it doesn't mean things weren't happening in the rest of the universe. There's an entire universe out there that's also happening side by side. So we're going to focus our attention on ourselves, but keep in mind lots of other things happening elsewhere in the universe as well. And then if we watch about 30 minutes here, we'll get time for some little small group discussion, and then we'll open up for discussion on that. So, all right, let's see if I can get this to work again. And Sharon, once I get this underway, if you would get the lights. To work. So let's see if that works.
Many of the world's greatest stories begin with a journey. A quest to answer life's most intimate questions.
How's the volume?
Where do we come from? Why are we here? From the dawn of time, all cultures have created stories to help explain the ultimate nature of things. And perhaps a new story is emerging in our time, one grounded in contemporary science and yet nourished by the ancient religious wisdom of our planet. What if the universe, even the Earth itself, has its own unique story to tell, one in which we play a profound role?
Big Bang. I like to call it the Great Flaring Forum. Imagine
billion years ago, everything in the universe, all the bright matter of the stars and galaxies, as well as all the dark matter no one has ever seen, all of it existed in a single point, so energetic it was trillions of degrees hot. Instantly, this micro-universe rushed apart, even faster than the seed of light. The discovery that the universe has expanded and is still expanding is one of the greatest of human history. The common understanding has been that the universe is simply a vast space in which things exist, large things like galaxies and small things like atoms. Scientists knew that matter changed form in the universe, but everyone assumed that the universe as a whole was not changing. But no. The universe is changing and has changed dramatically. The universe has a story, a beginning, a middle where we are now, and perhaps in some far distant future, an end. In the 1920s, the cosmologist Edwin Hubble trained his 100-inch telescope at the night sky. He was trying to determine if our Milky Way was the only galaxy in the universe. Not only did he discover the universe is filled with galaxies, he also determined that all of them are rushing away from each other. With Hubble's work, humanity learned that the universe began with a massive explosion that has been carrying the galaxies apart for billions of years. Another special quality of the universe is the rate of expansion. If the rate of expansion had been slower, even slightly slower, even a millionth of a percent slower, the universe would have re-collapsed immediately. That would have been it. After a million years, the universe would have imploded upon itself and formed a massive black hole. On the other hand, if the universe had expanded a little more quickly, even slightly more quickly, even, calculations show, 1/1,000,000% more quickly, the universe would have expanded too quickly for structures to form. It would have simply exploded. There would have been no galaxies, no structure, no life, nothing but dust for all time. So what we've discovered is that we're living in a universe that is expanding at exactly the rate necessary for life and structure to come forth. It could be that even though we can't call the early universe a body, we can understand it as life-generating. One of the physicists who is reflecting on this is the celebrated Freeman Dyson. And he mused that the more he reflected on the structures of the early universe, the more he became convinced that in some sense, the universe must have known from the very beginning that life was coming. Light from the beginning of time has been traveling for 14 billion years. Meanwhile, life has been evolving. With the recent emergence of advanced technology, we were at last able to see the story these photons tell about the birth of the universe and where we ultimately come from. Morning on a Greek island is like the first day of creation. And wandering around here, you feel like the first person. Inevitably, humans would ask, what gave birth to all of this beauty? What was the form of creativity that brought this form? Consider galaxies. What brought the galaxies forth? You know, even a century ago, this is hard to imagine. We didn't know if there were two galaxies in the entire universe. That was a main focus of attention among scientists. Now we know there are 100 billion, maybe even a trillion galaxies. What is the creativity that brought forth a trillion galaxies. Let's consider our own Milky Way galaxy. It's a galaxy with huge spiral arms. And when we first began to discover galaxies, we thought maybe these spiral arms were composed of physical matter. But actually, it's much more interesting. The arms are actually waves that are passing through the galaxy. They're called density waves. And as they pass through clouds of hydrogen and helium, they ignite starbursts. That's the way to picture the Milky Way galaxy. Not so much as a thing, but rather as an activity. It's an ongoing activity of bringing forth stars. We live in the midst of this intense creativity. Come into this little church. I want to show you something. The ceiling, as you can see, is filled with stars. The same is true of most of the churches on the island of Samos. The ancient Greeks, like Pythagoras, thought the stars were alive, even divine. Throughout history, every culture has been stunned by the presence of stars in the vastness of the night sky. So deeply moved by the majesty emanating from the brilliance of the stars, we have built our lives around them. We've even organized entire civilizations upon their beauty and order. Here's the essence of the universe story. The stars are our ancestors. Out of them, everything comes forth. Stars are dynamic entities. They're born, they develop, they even die. Star birth occurs when gravity squeezes together a cloud of atoms so tightly that nuclear fusion ignites in the center. In the process, hydrogen fuses into helium. This nuclear energy expands outwards and opposes gravity. So stars represent an amazingly creative balance between the powers of gravitational collapse and nuclear explosion. And once a star's nuclear fuel is spent, there's nothing left to prevent gravity from collapsing inwards, causing the death spiral to begin. This super-concentrated dot of matter, which we call a supernova, explodes outward with the power of 100 billion stars. And as it expands, it creates all of the elements: phosphorus, oxygen, carbon, gold. These are spewed out into the Milky Way galaxy, and then the whole process starts again. They drift as a cloud, and then they collapse, give birth to a star, the Earth. It's by this stupendous process that we can say the stars are our ancestors. It's just such an amazing discovery. The carbon atoms of this beet and of the lettuce and of, you know, our brains, our skin, all of it passed through an intense explosion of a star. In pondering the source of the sun's power, we can now reflect on something no earlier humans could know. The sun is converting 4 million tons of its mass into energy every second. All of life feeds on the roaring energy of the sun. Our solar system then is a self-energizing womb of creativity. And all of this had its start in a cloud of dust. It was really difficult for humans to realize that we live on a planet circling a star. I mean, we were here for hundreds of thousands of years before Aristarchus, 2,000 years ago, writing here on samples, realized we are spinning around the sun. That was such an amazing insight that it vanished, actually. And it wasn't until Copernicus discovered it again in the 16th century that humans really began to absorb the fact that we were on this planet. Let me use these vegetables to explain our solar system. So here we have the sun. This cabbage is the sun. Now, actually, if this were to be in scale, this cabbage would have to be a million times the size of this pepper. Budgetary considerations made that impossible. What we've learned in the 20th century is about the composition of the planets. First, we have the large planets. So we have Jupiter here, and we have Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. These are large enough to hold on to all the lighter elements so that they actually are gaseous. Too small to be a star, but yet too large to be solid. The other kind, then, we have indicated here with these rocks. So we have Mercury, then we have Venus. We jump over to Mars. These are the rocky planets, most of which are solid. But there's one special rocky planet, one that's not too small and not too big, one that's not too hot and not too cool, one that's not exactly solid, but not exactly liquid. We call it home. Earth is very much like an egg. The core of the Earth is like the yolk, the mantle of the Earth is like the egg white, and the crust of the Earth is like the eggshell. What happens is that early on, when the Earth is in a molten state, all of the really heavy elements like iron and nickel sink into the core. And then the elements like magnesium form this outer layer around the core, the mantle. The crust is only 10 to 50 miles thick, and that's the only solid part of Earth. All the rest is in motion. Plumes of molten rock will rise up from the mantle and harden into plates that form the crust. As these plates slide around the surface of Earth, they collide and crumble into majestic mountain ranges. Or they are forced back down, or they melt and sink toward the center of Earth. This discovery, which originated with Alfred Wegener, is called plate tectonics, and is one of the greatest of history. Earth became encircled by great tidal oceans and held by a thin layer of atmosphere. A churning volcanic Earth could now bring forth the next wonder of existence, the living cell. How are we going to tell the story of life? How did it all begin? What theory shall we offer to explain this? The simple truth is that no one knows with full certainty. But even though the detailed explanation still eludes us, scientists have begun to approach the whole question of life from a radical new perspective, that of self-organization. You see, during the modern period, we thought of the world as machine-like, and then life was an accident. But now, with the work of a number of chemists, notably Ilya Prigogine, who won a Nobel Prize for this work, we are beginning to discover the act of patterning in matter itself. It's intrinsic to matter. From this new perspective, life is not an accident. Life is inevitable. Life reaches a certain complexity of its matter, and then life blossoms forth. It's quite natural. Consider whirlpools. This spiral, swirling action can appear anywhere, so long as there is a body of liquid, moving water. It is not the water itself that endures as a spiral, because the water molecules are constantly flowing in and out of the whirlpool. It is rather the emergent dynamic structure that endures. Such is the nature of life. The universe began as a great outpouring of cosmic breath, cosmic energy, that then swirled and twisted and complexified until it could burst forth into flowers and animals and fish. All of these elegant explosions of energy. But it's not just energy. And it's not just living energy. This is energy that is aware. By awareness or sentience, we mean something that is more than what takes place in the realm of elementary particles, and yet less than full human consciousness. So, where does such awareness arise? Some biologists are beginning to speculate that awareness has its foundation in the very self-organizing dynamics of the universe. For cell biologist Ursula Goodenough, this awareness is a kind of primitive discernment, and it reveals itself especially in the membrane of each cell, that thin, skin-like layer that covers every cell. If we had microscope for eyes, we could see it all happening right here in these dipoles. There are millions of cells are swarming about, and they're encountering molecules over and over again, and with every encounter, discernment emerges. Why? Because a decision has to be made. An intelligent decision. Now, up in the cliff over here, there's an ancient castle that will help me explain. This church, which is called Metamorphosis, is nearly 1,000 years old. Above it is a castle, a once guarded entrance into the magical Potami Valley. The castle is built to do what membranes do. Get your friends in, keep your enemies out. The ongoing creativity of the universe is seen in the complex development of life itself. After it had circled the sun for hundreds of millions of years, Earth's most primitive organisms developed molecules that would resonate with the sun. How are we to picture this process involving Earth and sun bringing forth photosynthesis? As an engineering project? I guess, but try a new metaphor. Imagine two lovers longing for each other. What is it they truly desire? The relationship is charged with energy and promise. There's the sun exploding with brilliance. There's the earth basking in the sun's rays. But Earth is not passive. Earth's systems attune to the sun, changing their molecular structures in order to draw in light and convert it to food. As the complexity of life deepens, entwinement itself also deepens. How are we going to tell the story of the living Earth? In particular, how are we going to tell the story of Earth to our children? This is especially important because in the last couple centuries, we have learned more about the Earth than in perhaps the previous 100,000 years. So the question is, how are we going to convey that, the essence of that, to the next generation? One thing is completely clear. The Earth is very different than what we thought. The Earth is not a platform. It's not a background. In fact, the great discovery is this. Life doesn't exist on top of the Earth. Life is a partner to the oceans, to the atmosphere, to the land. For instance, if we look at the atmosphere, a It is 21% oxygen. This makes us unique among all the known planets. The only reason we have oxygen in our atmosphere is that life is pouring it forth each day. So the very composition of our air reflects the fact that life is here. In that sense, life is woven into the atmosphere. But an even more radical hypothesis is beginning to emerge in the minds of some scientists. Perhaps Earth is not only an integrated system. Perhaps Earth somehow maintains itself so that life can flourish. Consider temperature. Life only exists in a very narrow band of temperature. So something like this temperature has been true of Earth for 4 billion years. Now, scientists originally thought this was because the Earth just happened to be 93 million miles away from the Sun. But during the 1950s, we learned about the fusion processes taking place in stars. And so now we know the Sun's temperature has increased by over 25% over the last 4 billion years. Which means, somehow, Earth has had to adapt itself to maintain that stable, narrow band of temperature. How? We know some of the details. Early Earth had 1,000 times the carbon dioxide as present-day Earth. So during that time, the Earth's system has drawn the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, forming, for instance, the shells of marine algae. And then when the marine algae die, the shells go to the bottom of the ocean. So more and more carbon dioxide is taken out of the atmosphere, which enables the Earth to cool down while the Sun heats up. But the question returns, is all of this being organized by the Earth as a whole so that life can flourish? If that's the case, then the atmosphere is not just stuff. It's something like a membrane. And we are not living on the Earth. We are actually participants in a vast, intricate system that is something like a living cell. A living cell has the power to learn through time. This is what distinguishes the first cells from all the other beings that existed prior to life's emergence. A star, for instance, has the power to organize itself for billions of years. But throughout that time, it never needs to learn anything new. Life learns. For life can adapt itself to new situations by changing its form and by remembering these changes. Life remembers the past by storing information in its DNA molecules. It is this power of memory encased in each living cell that enables life to learn and thus evolve. One of the ways in which to understand the nature of life's memory is by using the ideas of the mathematician and philosopher Pythagoras. You know, a number of Pythagoras' ideas were revolutionary. And like a lot of revolutionary ideas, they weren't that popular. In fact, Pythagoras had to hide from the tyrant Polycrates, who was in charge of Samos. And tradition has it, this is where he hid, right here, halfway up the mountain, the cave there. One of Pythagoras' central convictions was that the essence of life is not air or water or fire, as the other Greek philosophers taught. Rather, the essence of life is number, pattern. It seems such an odd idea. I mean, life is so sentient, so complex, so rich. How can the essence of that be something abstract, like number or pattern? It is precisely this deep connection between life and pattern that enables life to remember its crucial achievements. That's what DNA does. In the precise sequence of the nucleotides, DNA holds the essence of life. Life did not hand down the actual molecules to my body. Instead, life handed their essence in the form of genetic information. Because of this, our bodies can come alive 1,000 different ways each day. life has learned to learn. One of the central ways of learning for our species involves seeing. Life has invented so many different ways of seeing. The amazing thing is, this process is not yet over. Come with me into Pythagoras' cave. Beginning billions of years ago, the earliest cells began to develop a sensitivity to light. They could sense it and move toward it. And it was this capacity that led eventually to the development of the eye. Now, the first eye for which we have any fossil evidence is that of the trilobite, 500 million years ago. The trilobite, intent upon piercing through the darkness, invented an eye using calcite and mineral. The trilobite was able to see only in the direction of these rods, a primal form of seeing that proved so successful, we find it even now in the compound eyes of flies and lobsters. An entirely different form of seeing was invented by the worms and carried forward by the fish. This type of eye is the one we know best, for it's the one we inherited. The water-based eye. Even after 500 million years, eyesight continues to evolve. In humans, the power of seeing deepens with a new kind of sight. Insight. We see the inner screen of our imaginations. Life has learned yet another way of seeing. One with the power to transform everything. With this new way of seeing, we find ourselves blinking in a thrilling and yet unsettling light. Rooted in the center of immensities, we open our eyes and see each thing anew, each thing ablaze with the cosmic creativity, billions of years old. With the insights made possible with conscious self-awareness, our vision now extends back through billions of years of evolution. We see not only the scurrying spider, but the entire cosmic journey layered into the spider's body, including even the distant stars, out of whose explosions its molecules were constructed. And this capacity to see into the depths of time gives new meaning to death. The universe throughout space and time is filled with violence and chaos. Millions of galaxies have been destroyed. Trillions of animals have been killed. Death and suffering are woven into the very heart of the universe. Usually such destruction is massive and senseless. A volcano erupts and kills every living being in its vicinity. But it also happens that dealing with death leads to more complex, co-evolutionary relationships. For a rabbit, an eagle bears the face of destruction. But in this relationship, the eagle develops more acute eyesight, and the rabbit develops greater speed for escape. Interdependent communities arise out of suffering and death. The ultimate meaning of this escapes easy explanation. We are confronted with a fundamental mystery in which the small self of the individual dives into and nourishes the whole community. But living beings are not just linked together by food.
All right, we're going to pause it there for today. And some lights here. So this is the first half. It's brought us up from, as I mentioned, from starting way big at the beginning of the universe itself and focused on our Milky Way galaxy, onto our solar system, onto our planet, the emergence of life, and now mammal life and complex life, and then we'll pick up on that next time here. But what I'd like you to do is to just turn to your neighbors for a few minutes here. We've got a few things I'd like to just find out, we'll just kind of pull the group. What did you find most interesting, exciting, or puzzling about this way of telling the story about the emergence of the universe? Any important concepts, insights, or discoveries that the film itself talks about that stood out for you about that? And does this raise any questions for you? So would anybody like to start us off with an insight, a puzzle, a question that was intriguing to you about this whole thing? You know, start up in the balcony. Any folks up in the balcony here? Evan. This is Evan's a member of my church back in Missoula area. I can pick on him.
He liked that all the elements were
from stars. So speak up a little bit so I can.
He liked that all the elements were formed.
So what do you think about that? This notion that everything in our bodies passed through a supernova at least once. It's kind of mind-boggling. I mean, for me as a geologist, one of the things that I've really, really been happy or excited about, and I also sound really weird, this is called geo-nerdiness. The notion that all the molecules and the atoms in our body get recycled. So I'm the kind of the constellation at this point in time for all these different atoms and molecules and things to come together as a living being. But everything in my body has passed through lots of other forms of life for tens of hundreds of millions of years. So it's really cool for me to think that I've got molecules in my body that were in dinosaurs, that were in trilobites, that were in ancient palm trees, whatever. That says, and so each of us is a unique constellation at this point in time of that, but everything in us has contributed to other forms of life since this planet emerged. And that everything in us passed through a supernova. I mean, everything in this room, everything on this planet. And so, I don't know about you, but that kind of makes my head hurt a little bit just to try to think what that actually means and there about that. And so what I love about part of the story here is that we have both this tremendous individual of uniqueness. Each one of us is a completely unique being that's never existed before and will never exist again. But we're also in incredible continuity with everything that's come before. So we're connected not only to each other in this moment in time, but we're connected to all of life through all of time. And we're kind of this interwoven fabric there that is somehow, and as far as we don't know if this exists anyplace else in the universe. It exists on Earth, and we're learning more and more about it. As far as we know it, it doesn't exist anyplace else in our solar system. So it's kind of this mind-boggling way of sort of thinking about, when we talk again about this question of origins, identity, and destiny, start putting into this kind of sense of scale here. So Evan, I think you're right. I mean, it's just really cool for me to think about everything in my body, or when I eat a banana, where the molecules in that banana have been to get to be that banana, and there, and how we pass that along.
And I don't know, you may help me edit this statement, because I don't know if I quite got it right, but the idea that more than people or entities have the ability to respond and communicate and adjust and to light and things like that, how would you restate what they
actually say? Let me talk about it. But first of all, the bell's ringing. If anybody's super hungry, feel free to let yourself out. I'm going to go probably to a little bit afternoon, and we'll spread the lunch out there. So you feel free to leave whenever you need to, but I'm going to go for probably another 20 minutes or so. So this is a really interesting idea that, again, I think that is so fascinating about this story. One of the things about the story, as I mentioned, is that there's what you see is this notion of continuity. And so in some sense, we are continuous with all the creative processes that have brought this planet, this universe and stuff about, and we're part of all that there. But the other thing about this story is the constant, what they talk about, the emergence of novelty. That this story, novelty just means new things here. That this story is not just a cycle that keeps repeating itself. It's moving through time, and there's some really incredible creative dimension to the universe. It keeps creating new ways of being in there. And so what they talk about here, one of the really incredible things, we don't think about it much here, but one of the very most important things was the emergence of atoms. Atoms was a way of beginning to self-organize or to organize matter that allowed for new combinations of matter. So it took billions of years for atoms to be able to merge. I mean, it took a long time from the origin of the universe until something that we think of so simple as a building block on an atom emerges. Once you get that, then you have the possibility of combining these into molecules, combining these into new combinations. But until the atom emerged, you couldn't get stars. Stars are self-organizing systems. And so part of what's so fascinating about this story is things that we think of as entities, as objects, it asks us to kind of rephrase and think of them as processes. So stars become processes by which energy and matter interact to produce all this energy and all these other things. And in many ways, we ourselves are processes that happen over a lifespan that we go through lots of different stages. So we're both simultaneously something and a process in that. And so this whole notion here, so stars was this emergence of novelty. Once you get stars, then you can get galaxies, right? Then you can get them self-organizing in the other ways there. Once you get those, then you get the process of birthing new stars, so you get new creativity. Once you get those, you get the process of supernovas possibly happening there. And without the supernova is a point where the energy in a star finally gets burned up, so it collapses inward under the pressure of gravity. And that incredible attraction there creates an enormous explosion. I don't know if you talked about it there, but you heard that, but a supernova has more energy in that event than 100 billion stars simultaneously burning. So when a supernova happens in the Milky Way, there's more energy released in that event at that moment than all the other stars in the Milky Way simultaneously. And yet, out of that supernova creates the diversity of molecules, the atoms here, the full range. If you had to study the periodic table, anybody here have to learn the periodic table in chemistry? Wouldn't it have been more fun if they told you that everything in that periodic table came out of a supernova? I just learned all the math and all of that, but nobody told me anything about where it came from and where it went. So what we see in this story is the emergence of novelty over and over again. And part of what's really fascinating is the emergence of senses, sensibility. So they focused on the eye. The evolutionists who study the eye estimate that the eye has evolved independently over 40 times our time here. We've inherited the water-based eye. There's other forms of eyes. But the notion is what the eyes allow an organism to do is to pick up on something that's out there, in this case, light waves, and to use that to our advantage. The emergence of hearing is another thing of sense there that allows us to take sense and understand the changes in sound pressure and vibrations from that. The emergence of touch. Each of our senses there. One of the really fascinating things about it is to think about the aspects of the universe that we don't have senses to help us understand. And one of the mind-blowing things for me to think about, and you've heard about this, is that people study this, they estimate that 90% of the universe actually consists of something called dark matter. That is, we have all this evidence that it's out there and exists, we have no way to sense it. Something, nothing in our bodies, nothing else in life has picked up how to do it. So we have a really strong sense it's there, it has all these effects on there, but we can't sense it by sight, by hearing, all the other things we've tuned on there here. But it raises it, are there other things in the universe that can sense dark matter, that evolved in such a way to do that? We don't know. But we're part of this whole process here. And so what he talked about, this we're going to focus more on next time here, this emergence of novelty. When human beings emerge from this really long process, and the estimate is that the human species have been around, Homo sapiens have been around about 100,000 years, somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 years, which for our life scale is really, really long. For the universe scale, it's just like we've disappeared instantaneously in the universe story. But what he mentioned there is what's really fascinating about that is he says, we move from the emergence of sight, the ability to see, to the emergence of insight, the ability to make sense of, to think abstractly. And so, as far as we know, we share all sorts of things with all the rest of the animal world on this planet. As far as we know, we're the only ones who can think of the concept of time and trace us all back through time on that. Every other form of life lives in the immediate presence in some sense. That doesn't mean they don't have a sense of anticipation, things like that. But with the emergence of humans, this novelty, we have a whole new way there. And what the authors of the story talk about is we are now the part of the universe that can think about itself. It took 13.7 billion years for the universe to evolve to the point where it can become self-reflective, which is really astonishing to think about it. And if you think about it, it means that the moment of the Big Bang, that potential was there. The potential for a Beethoven symphony, the potential for a Vincent van Gogh painting, that was all that potentiality lay there, but it's taken billions of years for this to play itself out. And so for those of us who come from a faith tradition there, we can start imagining where would God, or where would this notion of divine, the sacred, interplay with this story. I mean, for me, this is part of the richest part of the possibility there, because the story could have played out so differently. As they talked about there, one thing they talk about is what's they do in the film with the anthropic principle. Is when they talk about that notion that the universe has expanded slightly slower, would have collapsed back into itself, and if it was slightly faster, it would have expanded without that, we would not have the universe as well. It expanded at exactly the rate it needed to bring forth all these things, including us. Well, was there a divine hand in that? Was that just coincidence? These are things we can sort of speculate about here. But I think about our own tradition in terms of concepts like grace and contingent things like that here. You think about, for me, this is kind of a grace-filled story. There's all these places along the way where it didn't have to be this way, and yet another level of richness, an experience, a novelty emerged, and we are sort of at that point in the story now where the story's become self-reflective, and I'm talking way too much. Okay, back off here. Questions, comments, You guys got on a really good one, Evan.
Balcony up here.
I'm sorry. Josh, yeah. No, back over here.
Sure.
Somebody.
Josh. I don't know if people are pointing at me or, yeah.
No, go ahead. Part of the problem is that the people out there are backlit, so I can't always see them.
There's this proverb, this Serbian proverb, that I think is one of the most amazing things ever written, and it's so simple, but it's, be humble, you are made of earth, be noble, you are made of stars. And I just, in case that helps anyone with some self-reflection, I really love that. My math class in college was visualization and math, which maybe says something about my math skills. But we got to look at fractals and see these repeated math, is it equations that are repeated? I don't remember from visualization and math, probably. What I really liked about the video was this idea that it's the map, it's the patterns that do this thing that we often don't think of math and patterns doing. We think of that repeating itself and being all the same, but somehow this ability to adapt comes through math and patterns. Yeah. And that just reminded me of those pictures of fractals that end up looking like nature and flowers and trees. And so I really love that aspect of this. Yeah.
Well, and for me, it's this interplay of these kind of universal laws, universal patterns, things like that. But there's also freedom. There's randomness. There's novelty in there. So it's that interplay. I'll give you an example. And again, this is part of my geo-theo nerdiness kind of stuff like that. But Pat and I both teach the Book of Job in our honors college there. And for the students, it's the Book of Job is this fascinating story. And I don't know how familiar people are with it. It's usually read primarily as a meditation on suffering and justice in the world, which it has a lot to say about. But there's also this amazing, what I would say is the longest creation story in the Bible. And the basic storyline you may know is that God and Satan are having a bet. And they're looking at humans, and Satan bets God, if you make the human being suffer, you let me make him suffer, and he'll curse you. And so that sets up the story there, and then Job just goes through unimaginable sufferings as a result of this here. Raises all these profound questions. And what he wants is he wants God to show up to account for himself. He wants to basically put God on trial and say, how could you have allowed this to happen here? And so the whole story goes through almost 40 chapters of Job and his friends raising all these questions and stuff like that, but what he really wants is God to show up. So God finally does show up in that voice in the whirlwind. But instead of answering Job's questions, God just goes on and on about this magnificent creation God has made. And at one level, it seems like, God, are you just being tone deaf? Have you not heard any of these questions Job is raising? But on the other hand, it kind of shifts the attention of the story from Job's individual suffering to this incredible immenseness and beauty of the creation. And then Job's task is to try to make sense of himself being in that. That's a pretty simplistic summary of it here. But one of the things that has puzzled me for a long time, but I think is really fascinating, when God shows up, and it's a very different creation story than we get in Genesis. For the first thing, human beings are not part of the creation story. God narrates the whole creation of the cosmos and leaves humans out of it. So talk about a humbling aspect of the story. We're so used to being the culmination of the story as we are in Genesis. Here we're largely missing from the story. Secondly, when God brings up animals, they're all wild animals. They're animals who have no use for human beings and no use for human beings. And so this is, for those who want to embrace wilderness and wildness, it's really fantastic. But if you're familiar with the story, do you remember who God culminates his reservation and says it's the best thing, the playthings that he made? These two figures show up at the end of the story. Remember your Job?
Leviathan.
And Behemoth, right? Leviathan and Behemoth, the sea monster and the land monster. In the ancient Near East, Leviathan and Behemoth were symbols for chaos. They were symbols for the disorderliness that threatened creation. And so our own Genesis story is a later version of an earlier Babylonian story where the gods are trying to control these forces of chaos. And so creation comes out of chaos and God's bringing order to that there. But in Job, God brings about chaos, these symbols for chaos, is some of the best things he's done. And so you think about, wow, this is really comforting to Job, who's just God leaves Job out of the story and lifts up chaos there. But one of the things I talk about with our students here, and again, this is a bit of a stretch, this is the kind of thing where storytelling can be evocative. Think for a moment, any of you had to struggle through Darwinian evolutionary theory, right? How does evolution through natural selection work? And what does it produce in our world? I'm hearing lots of mumbling, but I don't have the courage to speak up.
Well, Darwin was struck by the suffering that was caused by this. But Darwin was a Victorian Brit who didn't have any suffering in his whole life. So. But
he actually had quite a bit of suffering. He contracted a terrible illness in South America that plagued him his life. But his 10-year-old daughter died, But the point you're not something really important here. But if just a simplistic form of evolution through natural selection, the basic insight is that all organisms have to be adapted to their environment. If they're not, they'll die. So one of the things that this story points out, because one, this is what we learn in geology, is the key insight is our environments are always changing over time. The Earth's story is changing over time. So that means there are always new challenges for organisms, and you've got three options if your environment changes. You can move someplace else, you can die because you haven't adapted, or you can change to adapt it there. And what Darwin's insight was is he said, what makes an organism possible to adapt to new things are these random changes in their DNA. He didn't know about DNA at that point, but we know now. But random changes in organisms, what we call mutations. And these mutations can give organisms under a changing environment, some organisms will have an adaptation. So what Darwin was pointing to is it's the interplay of fixed universal natural laws with random changes that introduce novelty. And that combination produces the incredible diversity of life we see on the planet there. So that's what I see going on in the book of Job. God comes along and says, Job, have you looked at my incredibly fantastic, beautiful world? And one of the best things I introduced into that world was chaos. Wow. But it's the interaction of this unpredictability and chaos with all the other things in there that produces a stunning biodiversity in the world there. And it also produces a mystery. Why do we live in a world that has suffering? Why do we live in a world that has death? Why do we live in a world of decay? And we can't, there's no obvious answer to that. We've tried many different things, but the book of Job offers this kind of interesting way to think about it in terms of God says this is part of the whole plan. And yes, your suffering is part of this world, but so is this incredible beauty and diversity, and somehow they're linked. What they do in the video where they talk about co-evolution, they show that really interesting interplay between the eagle and the rabbit, and the fact that one of the very strange things is that predator-prey relationships produce all sorts of incredible diversity and beauty in the world, but they come at the price of suffering and death. So kind of a mystery in there too.
But isn't that the movie explained that violence, and looking at the cosmic violence that happens, that's where creation emerges in the violence.
It's this paradox that the creativity that we see in the universe is wrapped up also in violence. I mean, there's this tension. And one of the story tries to narrate is that the universe itself emerges at the intersection of a significant tensions. The basic tension is between the force of attraction, which we know as gravity, and the force of repulsion. So the Big Bang begins in this incredible explosion, but it doesn't continue indefinitely. Because at a certain point, some of that matter begins to attract to itself, begins to form stars and galaxies, but then they explode outward. And they say, what we see so much in our own bodies, in our own life, is the same tensions. So our hearts beat with expulsion, contraction, expansion, contraction. This notion here, these very rhythms of the universe are just found woven in to so many different dimensions of here. And the irony, of course, we have these beautiful metaphors in our own faith tradition here. You know, when you think about the seed dying, and that brings the possibility of new life. The basic image of metaphor, of resurrection coming from death. But that's a rhythm, a pattern that's just interwoven into the universe here. And so, you know, I mean, it's easy. Well, I shouldn't say it's easy, but one of the ways I comfort myself, because I know intellectually I'm going to die, all right? It doesn't always seep in on a day-to-day factor, but having been through the death of both my parents, it's much more real at this point here. And now I have a grandson and a grandchildren. I have another generation coming along here, which just brings me tremendous joy. But I also am sort of coming to terms with the only way for new life to emerge on this planet and have a place to live is for earlier forms of life to make space for that, and that happens through death. And so that in my own dying, it will make possibility for other forms of life. And of course, what the planet does when it is allowed to is to recycle dead bodies or dead beings into new forms of life here. And so we have this thing. So it's again one of these fascinating patterns of the interconnectedness of all of the story there. But there's also tragic and difficult elements interwoven into as well that are harder to make sense of. Yeah.
This is kind of a bonehead physics question.
I'm sorry, what?
It's kind of a bonehead physics question. Oh. So if there is this continual creation adaptation towards a more desirable future, then where's the principle of entropy?
Yeah. No, it's a really good one because we know the second law of thermodynamics is entropy and so forth on that here. And that's what entropy is an interesting one. You have to ask at what scale you're talking about here. So at the scale of the entire universe is probably slowly winding down. And it's still kind of an open question whether it will collapse back on itself at some point and maybe start the whole process over again, or they'll just keep expanding and kind of run out. But that'll happen, you know, the number of years of time, we're talking about billions and billions of years still on that. Entropy at smaller scales so some people have said life itself kind of disproves entropy because we seem to be the contradiction of that here. That entropy is sort of any time energy is produced, some of it dissipates into unused form, so eventually it runs out on here. But I think, you know, in terms of the scales we have, what we see over and over in the life there, or the planet there, is that these interesting combinations of things produce unexpected results. Over time, entropy is still going to hold up, but at different scales.
Just way longer.
Yeah, way longer. Yeah, that's not a very good answer. I was a geologist, not a physicist. I apologize, but
Spence.
Yeah,
I was thinking about the mystery of potentiality.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, just
bringing it down to a individual person who was in a coma for a while, and then she woke up talking French, and she had never spoken a word or of French before, and none of her family could. It's called foreign language syndrome. Anyway, just I'm just thinking about the potentiality within our brains and within the universe, and could you speak a little bit more about
all of that? Well, I'll say that I tie a couple different things about that. One of the things I talk about in the movie is that we've learned more in the last 100 to 200 years than the entire species up to that point, 100,000 years. And the rate of knowledge expansion is just unbelievable. Nobody can keep track of it all. So, but what we're also finding is the more we learn, the more we know we don't know. And so like the mystery of the brain, we're unpacking more and more things all the time about the brain, but what we also find is it's just far more complex than we could ever even know. And the kind of potentiality on that. But this is one of the things I think is so fascinating when you start studying the universe itself. The thing about novelty is there's no way to predict it based on what's come before. So if you think about it, think about the ability to form the first atoms. There's no way to predict that that would result in galaxies. I mean, you know, it's happening, this microscope, but you put up through time there, and then genuine novelty emerges there. And the same thing when you think about the emergence of a cell. How is that cell going to eventually create human beings? You know? And so there's potentiality. I mean, the universe story seems to be woven through potentiality over and over again. How that potentiality is realized is a whole other matter, you know, on that. And so some people have told me, you know, this feels too formulaic, or particularly, you know, where's the mystery in this? Well, the fact, if you look at the story, it's just woven every single step of the way. There's no way to know it. And so it raises a really interesting question. Anybody here in the room read the book Sapiens by a fellow named Yuval Harari? Yes. See a few hands going up. It's a really, really fascinating book that I use in my class, and I've been out for a couple of years, and it tells the story of our emergence of our species in Homo sapiens. It's really, really interesting. But he has a sequel to it called Homo Deus, and where he's speculating what's going to be the next species after Homo sapiens, which is a kind of a troubling question, because we usually tell the story of life so it culminates with us. We don't think of ourselves as the link to the next phase in there. And yet that everything we know about the story of life on Earth, life just keeps going. It keeps evolving. And so raise a very interesting question about is there if or what or anything were to come after us on there, but that's part of that whole potentiality. But one of the things, maybe I'll end with this today, we'll pick it up tomorrow there, because it's kind of segue into this. Part of this emergence of novelty that's emerged with human beings is the ability to store information. I mean, for 3.8 billion years on Earth, information has been passed along from one form of life to the next through our DNA, through genetics. Now, with the emergence of human beings, we are now quantifying, codifying, and storing immense amounts of information that have nothing to do with our DNA. And in fact, we're using it to change our DNA. And so we seem to be at a qualitatively different point here. For the last nearly 4 billion years, evolution through natural selection has been the main mechanism, almost the sole mechanism, for life evolving here. That's changing now, right? Now human beings have this enormous power. We've become the most important driving agent for how life both survives and changes on the planet here. So we are, in terms of just the, you know, to step back and just into the universe story, entirely new, novel thing, at least in this neighborhood of the universe, has emerged. And the thing about the emergence of novelty is you can't predict the consequences. We just don't know what those consequences will be. We're in a moment. So it's both this, when Hal talked this morning about, you know, the Book of Mark was so important for his time because it was a point where there was so much violence and pain and trauma going on, but you couldn't know what the result was going to be, what we birthed out of that. And the Book of Mark is birthed into that moment to help people get sense of that here. We're in some similar kinds of things right now. I'm going to talk about that more later in the week there. You know, we are now in the geological sixth great extinction. There have been five earlier geological periods, a mass extinction of life on the Earth. We're in the midst of a sixth one here. This is the first one that's been caused by a species of the Earth. We're causing it. So we can describe this happening, we just don't know what the consequences will be. So it's a fascinating time to be alive, but troubling as well, raises a lot of really difficult questions. So thanks so much for being with me. We'll come in, those of you who are interested in things, tomorrow afternoon, we'll finish the second half of the story. And then the rest of the week, I'm going to look at how deep time helps us think through our different stories. On Wednesday, I'll talk about the geological story of the Pacific Northwest and deep time. On Thursday, I'm going to look at climate change, which is climate has been changing throughout deep time, but it's changing in particular ways now. And on Friday, I'm going to look at what we learn from deep time from life in a field called biomimicry. Can we learn from design patterns in life to help us address our challenges today? So if you're interested, I hope I'll see you back here again.